that, we'll move on to item eight, semi-annual disability retirement report. Mr. Hopkins.
We're going to just go through an update of the disability activity that took place in 2018. You'll remember we were back here, maybe back in July or August on giving an update mid-year. Now we're doing the full year update. In 2018, we accepted 30 disability applications. 16 came in the second half of the year. This compares to 27 in 2017 and 31 in 2016.
And can I just ask a quick question? Are these all living people, so to speak? Are any of these included in here, sort of the discussion we had a few weeks ago about the disability application filed after somebody's death?
It does not include the
active death ones.
In 2018, we processed three or four of the active death applications.
Okay, but they don't show up in this report.
No, they're excluded from this
one.
These are individuals that actually came in, met with staff, completed the application, provided the documentation to make it accept, met our the acceptance of the application.
Right, thank you.
Then I can add that to the future report if you
know,
want.
You know, and I know we're going to have a discussion in the future, but I'd really like to know that because that's, this opened up a whole new world of, I'm really curious about how many disability death applications we do end up with. How many we process each year? How many are granted? How many are denied?
I can add. We can add a section to the report on that highlights that information. And I actually have it back in my office where I keep track of it.
Okay.
On board activity.
Tim, before we leave Candace's topic, in our minutes of our last meeting, it discusses exactly this discussion. And then goes on to say we're going to look at it again.
Yeah.
I personally want to make sure we have that on a not too far down the road agenda to look at the rules that we follow in the process of somebody dying and then deciding they had a microsecond of disability and improving their benefits substantially because of that. That we are all clear on what our policy is as far as
agreed.
I just have a quick question. If we're on section one here, one of the things that jumped out to me just as I sort of reflected on it was how low in 2018 our non-service connected disabilities were relative to all other years. And just to ask if in putting this together, dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, is there a trend here that we ought to be aware of in applicants going to service versus non-service? The difference is dramatic.
The benefit that they're eligible for is significant.
Absolutely. My question is there something we ought to be recognizing when that distinction, when the difference in numbers becomes so great?
Well, I think part of it leads to is who is applying for the disability. And out of the 30 applications that were accepted, 23 were from safety members. And generally, where we have the safety member, we have the presumptions, or it's some type of bodily injury that they cannot fulfill. They have job restrictions that do prevent them from fulfilling all of the job requirements. So it's more tilted towards safety, and that's where we'd see a lot more service connected disability applications coming in.
Thank you. That was exactly the kind of response I was looking for.
Yeah, and we do, I'm going to say, and it's not all safety or service connected. I mean, it's rare, but it does happen that we end up with a few that are also non-service connected. Also, the Tier 3 provision is a very strict provision, as we've gone through, and a lot of those go to hearing, and we talk about substantial gainful employment. And their best case, the same substantial gainful employment, whether it's service connected or non-service connected, it's the same rule. And in order to get a non-service connected, they also have to have at least 10 years of service. And in some cases, by default, their only option is a service connected.
John, part of this, too, I think is, I worked the probation department, as you know, and retired out of probation. And we never had a safety retirement while I worked. I retired in 99. And before 99, they got safety approval. I think the probation department has always been way behind the sheriff's department and the fire in terms of knowing about being able to get a disability retirement due to injury on the job. So in my head, as we've been dealing with these through the last 5 or 6 years, I've realized that more and more probation people have been putting in for the permanent disability safety. And when I just looked at this in 2014, there wasn't anybody. Well, wait a minute. In 2014, there was only
one from probation.
Right, right. Wait a minute. Where did you go?
I'm
yeah.
on Exhibit 3, the Page first six. Column.
And then how many was this year?
For probation, 3.
Yeah.
That were accepted.
So two more people. So it's 200% increase. But I think there's a
people in earlier years would not have put in for disability from probation or not.
Exactly.
So.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I don't know about other departments, but from the probation standpoint, I think that's reality.
Yeah, and if you look at Exhibit 2 and 3, they provide a breakdown of where the applications are being received from. And last year, we had, out of the 30, 18 of them came from participating districts, the majority from Confire, San Ramon, and Moraga Fire.
It sounds like we're jumping around a little bit. I don't want to get you off course.
That's okay.
Here. Page 5 gives you a bit more detail on there, and I'm always interested in trends.
Yeah.
And some of these are good trends, and they're small numbers, I get it. I mean, they're so small, real
yeah,
numbers.
Yeah, that's one thing that's hard is, you know, our sampling is not huge, but it's what we have.
But trends, is particularly in musculoskeletal injuries, I mean, you've got Rinda Moraga has got 4 reported for last year, 2 reported for the prior 4 years. You've got San Ramon is also 4 this year and only 5 for the last 5 years. I mean, there seems to be upward trends there, and if you're looking for fire, that might be one thing, but some of the other numbers don't look that great. Safety, Sheriff's Department has shown a terrific improvement, if you will.
Right.
They've gone from 5, 5, 7, and 2 down to 1 last year. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder whether or not those are reflective of training issues. I understand there's a real physical nature to fire and to other safety workers. And so it kind of makes me want to know if the district is following it up, maybe more than we are, on whether or not there are reasons for these musculoskeletal blips or spikes, if you will, for Rinda Moraga and San Ramon.
I mean, the material we receive in the questionnaires provided by the employers describe or provide the reported accidents or the events where the injuries occurred.
And there any similarity in the?
I mean, I think a similarity, I think, is, you know, the aging of this population, and a lot of these individuals.
That doesn't suggest a good trend for the following year, which sounds like that group's going to be even older, and you may get more. But sheriffs seems to go counter to that.
Right.
That group's aging as well. Their
right.
numbers are way down.
And we talked about, I think, in the last report on how the sheriffs have dropped down considerably over prior periods.
They're not getting any younger.
No. But we're not seeing the physical as much as the physical side from the sheriff's side that we see on the fire side.
Yeah. I just wonder if this is something that those districts can pick up in the way of lessons learned of some sort, that there's one particular injury that seems to be common, or there's a thread amongst the injuries.
I mean, if I would say common injuries, it's generally what we see, and I'm going to now just off the top of my head, it's neck and back injuries.
It
is where I think we'd see a trend. But most of the individuals that we're seeing come in on the application side that are accepted are 50, say age 50 to age 55.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Now, as far as what activity has taken place, and I know the board has had a number of applications, you know, in 2018 that came before them as well as today. Of the 30 applications that came in, the board has granted 17 of those applications. From the date of last receipt of information to the board approval, it's taking on average 100 days to get through that process, which is probably one of the shortest time periods that we've been in right now. The information is being turned around quickly and we're getting responses. The medical advisor right now has unable to recommend a grant on two applications. In the prior report, it was three applications, but the applicant always has the opportunity to provide more medicals to support their case, in which time they may be approved. We did have one move from unable to recommend to being recommended based on the additional medicals that were provided. Right now, the advisor has five reviews in process that they're going through. We'll probably see those coming up at the April and May meetings. And we have two sets of records to still sort out and send to the medical advisor. Some of these records, I know the one that we have to sort is over 3,000 pages long of medical records to go through. And we have forwarded two cases to an IME for recommendation for further analysis. And we're also waiting on information still on two applications. We've got to the application process, but a piece of the information is missing to proceed.
I'm sorry, I should have brought this up on the consent calendar, but because I did notice we just flew through that, which we typically do. There's a date on here of one of these individuals. The effective date is 10/13/17.
Yeah.
So what, without necessarily going into too much detail, that's the sort of number. It could be, it's obviously an outlier, but this one's been hanging around for a long time. Is that like one of those that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, in this case, yeah, and the individual that you're talking about from 10/13/17, they also had service,
you get somebody
first service, and it was getting information from PERS. And so there was a delay from, you know, say a reciprocal system on data.
But that goes into your aging report though too, right, this one?
Correct, yeah, but the application date was 17. And so what I gave the 100-day average, we were talking about 2018. If you go further down on the page, there's a non-service connected disability, which the effective date is 8/3/18.
And since you mentioned PERS, historically, it's been difficult. Well, the time frame in when we receive information from CalPERS on some of these can be up to 12 months. So that factors into, you know, I know that CalPERS last year, they did a number of changes to try and reduce the time period because they had been getting a lot of, you know, concerns about the time frame it took them. So that's something to keep in mind.
Off the top of my head, sounds ridiculous. I mean, that kind of turnaround time. And we must have something to go the other way, where we've got somebody who's retiring in the PERS system that was in CSERA at some point. Do they have that difficulty getting information from us? I think probably not.
Probably not.
So do they care? PERS? Seems to me they should care.
I know that they've done some things last year around it, and then they actually did reach out and contact us, and they came and met with some staff to talk about reciprocity, to see what they could do even better. And so that was good that they were doing some outreach.
If it results in anything. Otherwise, it's just outreach.
But, I mean, sometimes, like I said, I mean, in one instance, it wasn't a disability application, but it was another county system. They provided us numbers, came back later and said, disregard those numbers, we're revising them. And it went on for 9 months, trying to get the correct numbers to use from the system.
Not to belabor this, but if you survey this individual at some point and ask him how this process is going, he's going to say, not too well. I've been waiting a year and a half. And he may or may not know that PERS appears to be the slowest moving part. Instead, he's blaming potentially us, CSERA, for the delay in getting his retirement allowance.
Yeah, I understand that, but in this case, we were in contact with this individual. He was aware of what we were waiting for, and I'm not going to put everything on, say, on PERS. The member also owed us documents in order to get him on payroll, and he was slow on providing us the documents, whether it was Social Security card, marriage certificates, birth certificates that we require. So he was aware. He knew what PERS owed us. He knew what he owed us.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So far this year, we've taken in 10 new applications. All are service connected. Nine are from safety. We just took one in this week and one tier one application. So that's where we are right now. We normally see the first 3 months of the year busier than the second 3 months of the year. And a lot of it has to do with they're filing service applications at the same time that they're filing disability applications to be eligible for the cost of living increase coming up.
Same question. Jerry Tellis said something earlier that made me think of this. In terms of whether a particular department or employee group is aware or not aware of maybe a benefit or an approach, what's the role of our benefits counselors in that process? In other words, somebody comes in and files a disability app or I'm not sure where this happens, but they file a disability app. And it seems maybe patently clear that it's service connected, but it comes in as a non-service connected. What if anything do we do in that situation?
Well, I'll say in some cases, what happens is the individual comes in to fill out a service retirement application, and they'll make a comment about my back. I can't work any longer because of my back. The counselor could ask, you know, on the disability side, and they will then bring in one of the disability counselors that will run through the disability process, the disability application, the requirements for it. And in most cases, the mindset is going in the direction of service over non-service because of the benefit difference.
Okay. And I had a second question, unrelated. Of the two, you mentioned there were two pending matters where the medical advisor was unable to recommend, but the applicant was able to provide additional medical information.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, what's the nature of the additional information? Is that providing medical records that hadn't been provided previously, or is it going out and getting an expert opinion from someone else about the nature of the disability?
In the case that I mentioned, it would have been the individual is having, say, an AME performed after the date that their application came in and their medical records went to the medical advisor. On this one instance, it was the medical advisor issued their report, and I'll just say, December 15th, and on December 17th, they had an AME performed that gave more current, up-to-date information on their disability and their restrictions.
Okay. It's I realize we have to speak at a very high level on these things. We can't get into, the actual cases. It just struck me that, there was a sort of a unable to recommend based on an application already filed where presumably the applicant has the burden. And now I'm able to recommend because of some change, and I'm trying to get at what that.
Yeah, I'd say it's more current medical information provided to the medical advisor after the report was issued or during the report process. In one of the cases, the two applications that are still unable to grant, the member has or applicant has provided additional medicals at least two other times that were still found not to be sufficient. And so it would be, their next step would be requesting hearing.
Okay, and I was just trying to discern between additional medical that's treating physician additional medical and additional medical that's something else, expert opinion, whatever.
Right, yeah, it would be coming, say, from a QME and AME, it would be coming from a specific exam that was performed. And okay. I say generally it's not coming from their own physician, especially if it's, say, work-related. They're going through the risk management in the case of the county.
Does the medical advisor weight or value the treating physician information submitted as maybe a higher value type of medical evidence than something else?
I would say generally we rely on, if it's a service connected, we're relying on the records we receive from risk. He's relying more on risk management than on personal records in a service connected situation.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, you're welcome. Any other questions?
Anything else? Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks.